This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, it's another episode of Science with Dr. Carl in your podcast feed, and I'm going to sound the alarm because we've only got two more live episodes left between now and the end of the year. God, it came up quick, didn't it? So that means two more opportunities to get on the radio and ask Dr. Carl your science question. We take the questions on the Triple J text line 0439 757 555 live on Thursdays from 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time before we take it around the nation live, Science with Dr. Carl at 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. Or of course, you can always listen back right here on the podcast. For this week's episode, we were joined by Dr. Teresa Larkin, friend of the show, friend of the hookup on Triple J, answering all our questions about hormones, about bone density, about period shits. If you know, you know. Let's get into it. Now, Dr. Carl joins us in the studio, but Dr. Carl, we have a very special guest.
That's right. We have the absolutely fabulous Dr. Therese.
Yes, Dr. Teresa Larkin is with us on Triple J. Now, Teresa, you're a friend of the show. You've been on before. You've been on The Hookup. You hang out on ABC Illawarra. And you are wearing an Oz Music T-shirt for Oz Music T-shirt Day. Do you want to tell us who it is?
I thought I couldn't go past art versus science.
Yeah. Oh, it's perfect. Art versus science, absolutely.
Love
and
it.
Something about the visual of this one as well. Do you want to give us a bit of a talk us through it?
Absolutely. So I already thought I've got to go with Art vs Science as the band. Love them. They're great. I've seen them before. And there's too many good Australian music artists to choose from because one of them was doing art, one of them was doing science at uni, but the other was doing languages, and that's my third top thing. And then I saw the T-shirt. It's perfect. It's got mushrooms. It's got eyes. It's got an alien. What else represents
I feel like
the science hour?
Absolutely. This is the Venn diagram of Teresa Larkin of Science with Dr. Carl. So good. You mentioned actually as well in choosing this shirt that has mushrooms on it. It's mushrooms have gotten a bit of a bad rap in 2025. Do you have a good mushroom story? What's something that you've discovered recently about mushrooms?
I do. I thought it was nice for mushrooms to have a good news story at the moment. Something that's super interesting about mushrooms is that when you leave them out in the sun, especially if you put them upside down or sliced, they can absorb vitamin D and be one of the best food sources of vitamin D that we can get.
Really?
Yeah.
Do what? They? But they mm-hmm. don't get sunburned.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, because they have, so in us, in our skin, we have a precursor to vitamin D in our skin layers, and it's actually a derivative of cholesterol. The mushrooms have the same thing, a slightly different derivative, but a derivative of cholesterol, the UV radiation, in the same way it converts it for us, converts it to vitamin D.
Wow, and then we digest it and we can, oh my God, that's crazy. When did they discover this and how did they discover it?
Well, I guess it's one of those things that they've also noticed has changed in a negative way in terms of mushrooms being farmed indoors, you know, lots of right. like hydroponically grown or whatever. They have a reduction in the vitamin D level. And so, yeah, then, and I guess it's known that there's quite a few things like fish as well can accumulate vitamin D. That's from eating the plankton and things like that. But yeah, the mushroom skin, super interesting.
Wow, so interesting. Claire Collins goes on about mushrooms being good, but here's an extra benefit that they can go out in the sun and you don't have to get their vitamin D.
Yes.
That's perfect.
Absolutely.
That's right.
So Teresa, what kind of questions would you like to answer today? What kind of topics do you reckon you could go down for the audience?
Look, anything on the human body, you know, hormones, the skin, hair, what changes with our as we age. I guess the skin's a relevant one coming into summer. What happens with the sun, sunscreen, UV. Maybe people are suffering from allergies still as it's spring. So, yeah, anything. They're sort of topical ones I can think of, but happy for anything.
All things human body. Mm-hmm. And, of course, your regular questions for Dr. Carl. Send them in right now on 0439 757 555. And we're going to kick it off with Georgie in Nam, Melbourne. Now, Georgie, what's your question?
Hi, team. I was just wondering if you are born with all the eggs that you are going to have as a woman, what happens to the eggs if you are on like birth control and you skip your periods, and then are the eggs, are you like prolonging or, you know, what's the word, delaying menopause, or how does that affect your hormones?
Super interesting question, Georgie. So happy to start with this one. So we are born exactly as you say with all the eggs that we're going to have, and that's around 1 to 2 million at birth, which is crazy. But already from birth, the number of eggs in the ovaries start to reduce naturally. So they just basically die off, and that's a normal process. by the time we get to puberty, we've got hundreds of thousands of eggs still. And then, as you say, that reduces until we get to the point of menopause when there are none left. But that's a fairly long time. So that's from, say, average age of, I don't know, like 14 for periods to 51 for menopause. So over a lifetime, only around 500 eggs will be ovulated, even if a person never took birth control, was never pregnant, never breastfeeding. So the 500 that are ovulated in a lifetime is really nothing compared to the 100,000 or so we've got to start with during the reproductive years. So basically, when you're on birth control pill or you're pregnant or breastfeeding and you're not ovulating, you're only missing out on one every month. And so that's nothing in comparison to, and this sounds like an awful phrase, but it's true, to the numbers that are just dying off naturally every month anyway. So it doesn't have any impact on the time to menopause or your fertility, and that just will naturally decrease until that time point of menopause.
And every now and then, very rarely, there's a case of a woman who is carrying eggs that do not have her DNA.
Mm. What do you mean?
They do not have her DNA. And this came to light when a woman with three children had kidney disease, and so looking in the family for a transplant, and found that two of her three children did not carry her DNA. And they worked out that what had happened was that when this woman, before she was born, was in her mother's, the grandmother of the kids, was in her mother's uterus, there was a twin. And they got together and then merged and then threw away most of the other twin. And so she was a hybrid, and through her body, some of her cells had her DNA and some had her sister's DNA. And so then she ended up with her being able to give birth to kids from her, from her husband's sperm, that had her sister's DNA, her sister who had never been born, who got reabsorbed into her early on. And this sprung to mind when I read a story this week about a woman who had her brother's DNA in some of her white blood cells, and they're figuring that's what's going on. And then suddenly I did a big leap, and I thought, you know, the whole difference between sex and gender? What if some of us had twins of the other sex who got merged with us, and some of their cells are in different parts of our brain?
So wild.
So wild. I'll just stop right there.
A lot to think about. Teresa?
And that actually brings up another point, Dr. Carl, that's super interesting, people will find interesting. The egg that made all of us was in our biological mother's ovaries while she was in her biological mother's uterus. So the egg that made us was in our maternal grandmother. We were already, so the connection
three generations
of that,
back.
Three generations of that maternal lineage. It's so amazing, isn't it?
Wow, Georgie, does that
help?
Yeah,
thanks, Georgie.
You've opened a can of worms,
my question,
Georgie.
Thank you.
We've gone, we've gone down a full lineage. Sarah in Berwick. Sarah, common sensation,
hello.
Common experience. What do you want to know?
So I would like to know, pretty fitting for Oz Music T-shirt day, but if you go to sleep with a song stuck in your head, why it is that it can still be stuck in your head the next morning.
Sarah, is this speaking from experience? Did you have a song stuck in your head last night? What was it?
It is. It was actually a couple of nights ago. I had F My Computer from Nina Durachi stuck in my head.
Yes.
I'm actually wearing her tee at the moment, but that's kind of what prompted the question.
Love it.
So waking up the next morning and it was still just as fresh as the night before.
And like, look, not a bad problem to have, but definitely something that can hang around. Dr. Teresa, can you speak to this?
Yeah, and it is a good problem, isn't it? It's a nice thing when you wake up. So it's a really good sign of just how much the brain is doing overnight while we sleep.
Oh.
Yeah. So essentially, especially doing that during that rapid eye movement sleep, and we have different cycles of sleep during the night, and that's why it's important, you know, to have good sleep health as much as you can. It can't always work. And so, yeah, the brain is processing memories, it's processing learning. And so often then if you are sort of thinking about a song or you've got it in your head, as soon as you wake up, the brain's like, I've processed this and this is what we're doing, which is why, you know, there's often the advice to do, if you've got to study for something and you've really got to do some learning, it's good to just do a little bit before you go to sleep and let your brain sort of settle with that and process it overnight.
Wow.
Yeah, it's where it sort of lays down our memories and it even does some thinking for us. You know, sometimes you wake up and you're like, I feel like I know what I should do in that instance.
Mm.
And it's similar to, that can happen as well. You know, people sometimes get their good thoughts in the shower or when they're daydreaming. And I feel like, I know about you and others as well, but sometimes when I'm going on long walks or just walking and you get into that zone or maybe you're doing a certain exercise, that's one as well you can just have a song on repeat because I think it shows that you're in flow.
Yeah, right.
So it's a good thing to have, I think. Music is great anyway.
Yeah. Sarah, does that help?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'll take it as a good sign.
Exactly. It's a good sign.
100%. And Russell in Gardiner's Bay. Russell, it's cold down there. What's happening?
It's freezing, doctors, and I just want to know, has it got anything to do with the warmer currents up north? Is like we haven't had any sort of warmer spring days as of yet. It's just been blowing cold and sleet.
Well, you really need a professional meteorologist to answer that because I'm only a generalist. But there are three main weather patterns affecting Australia. One is the El Niño-La Niña, where when you have the pool of warm water off the east coast of Australia, you get lots of rain. The other is the same thing on the other coast in Western Australia. It's called the Indian Ocean Dipole. Same deal. You've got a big pool of water, you get lots of rain. Third one, around the Antarctic, you've got a circle of winds. Check it out on Null Earth. Tip the Earth up and you can see them. And these winds are running in a clockwise fashion with a whole bunch of clockwise cyclones in them, and they can expand and contract. On top of that, we're finding that the East Coast Current... Okay, here's another weird thing. Australia is the only continent that has warm water running from the equator to the pole on each side. Every other continent, one up, one down. Australia, both sides down. And the East Coast Current is changing. And just because it's bringing warm water further doesn't automatically mean you're going to get warm. You know, it's a complicated system. So at this stage, I'll just stop and maybe we'll get a meteorologist soon.
That'd be good.
There's no easy fix. You can't just... and close the fridge door.
Mm-hmm. The fix is easy. All you have to do is six words, keep fossil fuel in the ground. But the trouble is the fossil fuel companies will reduce their profits. And can you sleep at night knowing that you were part of that, the guilt?
It is a hard one, doctors. Thank you.
Speak on it, Carl. Thanks, Russell. Mikey in Melbourne, how you doing? What's your question?
I'm doing fabulously well, thank you. I've got a question about measles and the erasure of immunity. I'm wondering if what I've heard about measles erasing immunity is correct, and if it does, how that happens.
So the immune system is horrendously complex, and I'll just deal with one way of subdividing it. They've got the B cells, and the way I remember what they do is B is a letter in antibody. So one of the things they do is make the antibodies. They sit in your lymph nodes, these B cells, they release antibodies, they travel around your body. They grab onto bad guys with the open, they look like a letter Y. The antibody looks like the letter Y, and it grabs onto the bad guy and makes a perfect match. The tail lights up and along comes a T cell, T for travel. They travel around the body. What we've discovered is, well, firstly, both the USA and Canada, after years of being free of a measles, now have it, and people are already dying from it, and they don't have to if they get vaccinated. But we discovered that there's a temporary immune amnesia. We're just learning about it, and what happens is that you lose some, but not all, of the immunity in your B cells, and we're trying to work out which things you lose and for how long. So it's not automatic that if you get measles that you've lost your immunity to polio, right? But we're just finding out. So the bottom line is try to avoid getting measles. And if you do, then go and see your GP about it and then go down a pathway of getting revaccinated against everything.
Fantastic. Do we know how that happens?
You'd have to ask the clever people in immunology. They're the really clever ones. Dr. Teresa?
Yeah, I don't think they know how that happens. And as Dr. Carl said, immunology is so complex but super interesting. And yeah, just to highlight, it means that then you might be more susceptible to other viruses and diseases, as Carl said, but you still have the immunity to measles. But that's also why the vaccinations are important, to give you that immunity without having to have these effects of the disease.
Yep, get vaccinated. This has been a PSA.
Thanks, Mikey.
Thank you.
Thank you. We got Zoe in Connor Country. Now, Zoe, you've got a question about contraceptives and IUDs. What's up?
Hello. I'm just wondering if oral contraceptives or hormonal IUDs have any impact on bone mineral density in women?
Yeah, it's a good question. So they are important because the hormones that we have naturally during our reproductive years, so especially estrogen, that's actually quite protective for our bones. It's also protective for cardiovascular disease and things like that. And that's one of the reasons that when someone approaches menopause and then goes through menopause, their hormone levels drop off, and that means that the bones are susceptible to breakdown, which means that then they can have a reduction in bone density and increased risk in fracture. So it is true that having hormonal treatments can help with that because they maintain good amounts of estrogen and progesterone, and they can then, yeah, have a nice protection against the reduction in bone density and also a protection against the increased risk of cardiovascular disease that comes with menopause, because until that point, we've had the protective effect of estrogen.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Did you want, yeah, was that all good?
Yeah, that's all good. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
I love that.
I was just captivated.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering if you had anything else.
She was too stunned to speak. I love it. Zoe, thanks for your question.
Thank you.
Hey, we've got Heath in Mildura here. Now, Heath, talk to us. You got a question about space junk. What's going on? Where have you gotten with this one?
I was just wondering if there's any evidence of previous civilization space junk floating around in space.
Wow, I love this.
Yes and no. No, in that there isn't. But yes, there are some memes on various conspiracy theories. One of them is called the Black Knight. So look that up and then see what Brian Dunning says about that as well.
Night as in the night sky, or night as in night in
shining armor? K-N-I-G-H-T, right. with a letter K. The K is silent. So with space junk, that's overwhelmingly being monitored by NORAD, among many other organisations. NORAD, North American Air Defence, and I was lucky enough to actually get inside that hollowed out mountain, which they used to have as their defense against nuclear weapons landing on their control center of NORAD. And they monitor stuff in space down to a certain size. And they started off in the early days. They did not find anything bigger than 10 centimeters. They can see down to 10 centimeters that was left behind by a previous civilization. Another factor, however, is that there is drag. Even at 400 kilometres above the ground, there's still some air. In fact, the air, Earth's oxygen reaches to the moon. We have proof of that. Not much, but a little bit. And with the space station, every day in altitude, because of wind resistance, it loses 70 metres. That's because it's travelling at 28,000 kilometres an hour. It's 100 metres across and 20 metres by 50 metres. It's big and fast. But on Bastille Day in the year 2000... the sun heated up the Earth's atmosphere with a coronal mass ejection. The Earth's atmosphere expanded. And in that day, instead of losing 70 metres, it lost 15,000. Yeah. And they had to pump it up with rockets. So it is possible that the aliens did leave something behind in Earth orbit. If I was an alien, I wanted something left behind, I'd probably leave it. If I was happy with, say, 100 million years, I'd leave it on the surface of the moon. If I wanted it to last longer, I'd dig a cave, make it very obvious and leave it just out of direct impact of micrometeorites, which would smooth it off after a while. But so far we've got nothing. Right. But look up Black Knight if you want to go down that rabbit hole for a little bit.
Yep, no worries, will do.
Thanks, Heath. And we've got Michelle in Wollongong. Michelle, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. I just wanted to know, when a female athlete does an excessive exercise block, it may have some kind of adverse effects on their reproductive health, such as their menstrual cycle stopping. Does the same thing happen in any way, shape or form to male athletes? Like, do they have a lower sperm count, or does their sperm, you know, become inactive, or is there any adverse effects on male athletes?
Good question.
Doing the same thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And honestly, I don't think anyone's really saying anything about that. I've never really thought about it.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. So one of the biggest things, Michelle, is that with the reduction, as you say, in the hormones, or sorry, the reduction, one of the things that where the effect is on females is the reduction of fat content. And fat content is important for energy reserves, and it can also have an impact on the hormones to impact menstrual cycle, as you say. So actually, excessive exercise also has a stress effect. So it can increase the hormone cortisol, which is the stress hormone. And there's always a balance between stress and sex, evolutionary speaking, because if people or a population or an individual is stressed, then the body thinks, well, we don't have enough energy reserves or the capacity to reproduce. So everything affecting sex goes down. So the more that intense and excessive exercise is a stress, in males, that can also reduce testosterone, which can then have effects on libido and sperm production and sexual activity and things like that. But another thing, similar to how a reduction in body fat impacts females and their hormones, males and females as well, but in males, the fat tissue is actually what converts testosterone to estrogen. That happens in all of us. And estrogen is also important for male health. So for those same things, for sperm production, libido, erection. So we still need estrogen. So it's something that honestly I've never really read about or heard about. So thanks, Michelle, you're making me think of it straight off. But this is still true. So yes, the impact of the cortisol and the stress hormones, as well as any impact on real excessive loss of fat, could have those kind of impacts. But as I said, I don't know if there's really been any big studies on that.
There's a mechanical effect. So with fighter pilots who undergo high Gs, when they're doing the training where they're undergoing the high Gs, the percentage of sperm that are able to make male babies drops because XY is smaller than XX. Y is just an X with one of the arms dropped off, you know. So it's a smaller, more fragile bit of sperm. And so on one hand, the male pilot, the pilots have lower sperm counts when they're doing, that will lead to male babies. So it should really be called the wild pink yonder, because they'll have girl children rather than the wild blue yonder. Mm-hmm. And secondly, another offside, this is going immunological, it's been said over and over that at the Olympics, the athletes are so highly trained. And boy, they can run or jump or whatever it is, they do really well. The slightest infection comes through, they all fall over.
Wow, yeah.
So there's a whole keeping them away from even the common cold.
Interesting. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
We've got Liz in Darlinghurst here. Liz, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. I'm just wondering whether the big hormone fluctuations you have postpartum play a role in postpartum hair loss, or is it just due to the big stressor of going through childbirth and having a newborn?
Is this a personal thing for you right now,
yes,
Liz?
Yes, I am balding.
What's the deal? What's going on, Teresa?
Oh, goodness. Well, yes, congratulations on being postpartum. And I hope there's a lovely new baby there. So, yeah, absolutely. So during pregnancy, the increase in hormones, especially estrogen, it does affect where the hair is in terms of the cycles. So hair goes through different cycles where they grow. That can last for several years, and that's why the hair on our head can grow so long. And then it goes through this transition phase where it sort of stops growing, and then a resting phase where the hair still sits in the follicle and then it falls out, which is natural. And pretty much every hair on the scalp is replaced every 3 to 5 years. But what happens is that the increase in estrogen during pregnancy leaves all the hairs in that resting phase. So they're sitting there. So you have less falling out. So the hair becomes much thicker and there's more hair. And then when the hormones drop off, when the estrogen drops off post-birth, then all the hair starts falling out. So they all essentially shed at a similar time.
So it's not that there's so much hair falling out, it's just there's not as much replacing it. Is that it? Or
it's more that they all end up cycling into the same cycle. Mm. So instead of, say, you often having some hair fall out here and others are in a process of growing back so you don't really notice it, it's that all the hair has then aligned. So it's all sitting there during the pregnancy, and then after birth, they all fall out at the same time. So it can appear to be balding, but it's just that they're not, because it's better for us to have the hair out of sync. Otherwise, we'd have hair for a few years and then it'd go and it'd come back.
Yeah. Dr. Teresa, do you know anything about hair serums or things that promote hair growth? Is that just a myth, or do those things actually work?
Well, one of the things that they use for male hair loss is a treatment that essentially just opens out the blood vessels on the scalp to try and increase blood flow. But we can't really change the cycle of our hair. So that's genetically determined. It's happening all the time. So, yeah, really with the postpartum, I think it's a phase where it'll seem as though the hair is thinning. So, Liz, it's not going to be forever. It'll seem like it's a bit balding, but until the rest of the hair follicles then grow again and you'll have them back to, it should come back to normal.
Now, before you go back to Liz, can I ask a question? So is this related to women just glowing during certain periods of pregnancy, and is that part of this full mane of hair that you say that they, being instead of being out of sync and then falling out different times, they just stop falling out temporarily?
That's right.
Wow.
They sit there. So you've
no
got
idea.
Extra hair just sitting in all the follicles. So essentially a pregnant woman has very few empty hair follicles. They're all full, but then afterwards a lot of them all fall out. Whereas all of us, we have lots of hair follicles with the hair still in them growing, but we have a number of empty ones that are then going to start to grow again.
Liz, it's just a phase.
Thank you.
Thanks. Keep us updated.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure a lot of hairdressers have seen this too. Kinley, you're from Ngunnawal country. What's your question?
Hi, yeah. So festival season is coming up and it's so important to wear sunscreen, but I also like to wear body glitter. So I was wondering, is it better to do sunscreen first and then body glitter and then sunscreen? And does it affect, the efficacy of the sunscreen at all?
Ooh, great question.
Well, I only know a little bit about it because it's complicated, but I found out that the reason that you wait 20 minutes is not to allow chemical reactions to happen, but rather the fact that the sunscreens are overwhelmingly oil-based and they take a little while to spread. Think about painting a wall at home with one coat of paint and you go, oh, it's a bit blotchy there. You put on a second paint, it evens out. But the same thing happens when you put on the sunscreen, but because it's oily, it will spread, but you need those 20 minutes to spread. So maybe let it spread for 20 minutes and then put on the glitter. And underneath the glitter, you will get less sunlight, of course, and you will perhaps get a tiny little bit of whiter skin underneath the glitter, perhaps.
Dr. Teresa?
Yeah, so I love this question because, as you say, it is coming into that festival season with glitter. And as to your question of which to put on first, so yes, in line with what Dr. Carl just said about certain of the sunscreens, they need time to absorb, essentially. They're the chemical versions of the sunscreen, so they have a lot of complex chemical names. We also have sunscreens that are essentially just a physical barrier. They're the ones like zinc oxide, titanium oxide, and they, with those, you can essentially go out into the sun straight away because they're sitting and they're blocking the UV. So it would be better to put either of them on first. Putting the glitter on the top, it's only going to make you look nice and glittery. It's not going to take away from the sun protection because you've already got the layer on and it shouldn't affect the time that you need to reapply. Obviously, going in the water. So if you've got glitter on and then you're partying in a pool, you'll need to still replace the sunscreen regularly. But in terms of the protection of what the sunscreen's doing to avoid UV radiation penetrating through the skin layers to cause cell damage, then the sunscreen will do that and the glitter can just be applied on top.
Sweet as.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah,
thank you
so enjoy.
I just only thought if you put the glitter on first, then you put the sunscreen, there's a bit of skin that doesn't have sunscreen on it. And then in the surf, if the glitter shifts, you know, maybe 2 millimetres, there's this little tiny patch of skin that has neither glitter nor sunscreen or sunblock.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Got to be careful. True. Kinley, are there any festivals that you're heading to soon?
Yeah, I've got good things coming up next weekend up in Sydney, which I'm super excited for.
Sweet. So good.
And it's yours truly, local Sydney band, so keen. Ooh. And, of course, all time low, my faves.
Oh, the best. We'll have a really great time and I hope that helps.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kinley. And we got Alex, also in Ngunnawal country. You got a question about hormones. And this is one that I see pop up a little bit. Alex, what do you want to know?
Yeah, hi, doctors. My question is, how do hormones like progesterone affect your bowel movements? So basically, what causes period shits?
Yes, Alex. Something we've all been wondering.
Totally. It's a good question. And so estrogen and progesterone can both affect what we call gut motility, so how fast things are moving through your digestive tract. And it's interesting because progesterone is quite high in the second half of the period. And actually, progesterone causes more constipation than diarrhea. And so I wonder if anyone's pregnant and listening or has been pregnant, if they experience that during pregnancy, because we have a much higher amount of progesterone during pregnancy. So what happens, Alex, is that just before our periods, the progesterone and the estrogen, they drop off. And it's the drop off, especially in the progesterone, that makes our gut go from something that was moving more slowly to moving more quickly. And that's absolutely why you can have looser bowels, especially at the start of your period. So yes, the drop off the progesterone before then. And so I'm not sure if you've experienced both of those. I've definitely experienced the period shits?
Period shits.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced that. But I can't think about necessarily constipation leading up to the period, but it's sort of just maybe not something you notice. So I'm not sure if you've noticed that too, Alex, or just the diarrhea with the dropping off of the progesterone.
Yeah, I guess it was kind of more of the second half. I only asked the question because I just got a Mirena put back in
And I found that it also actually seemed to make it worse, which sounds like is the opposite what I would have expected considering it's increased my progesterone. So it's so strange. I wonder if it's just because of my weird endo-PCOS hormone situation.
Oh. It could be. Or also that's super interesting with the Mirena, because the thing with all of our hormones is that it's not just about one or the other, it's about the balance. And so maybe for you, you've gone to the balance of hormones in the Mirena being different with the estrogen versus progesterone to what you normally have. So it might be that, and hopefully it will settle.
Mm. Wow, cool. Thank you so much.
And on the PCOS, the wrongly named polycystic ovary system, there's a wonderful article in The New Scientist a few years ago by the Australian correspondent whose name escapes me. And she, honestly, just read that article. New Scientist, PCOS. It'll open your mind to a whole lot of new things.
Amazing. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Darren, you've got a question for Teresa about blood types. What's going on?
That's right. I'm just wondering why humans have different blood types. And say, for example, like dogs or different animals have the same blood type, or they have different blood types as well?
Oh, very good question. So, yeah, we do have different blood types as humans, which you would know about. So we've got the O, the A, the B and the AB. So really interesting, the reason we have all of those different forms is basically our evolution. So the oldest blood type is blood type O, and that's still the most common type amongst all humans across the world. Mm-hmm. And that's super still, I think like more than 95% of people in Africa still have blood type O. And then it's really interesting to look at a map of the world and see where there's commonly O, A, B and AB. And that's the order in which they developed. And so they develop in response to viruses and pathogens and things in the environment, because the O blood type, it doesn't have any spikes on the outside of the cells. So they allow us to mount immune responses, for example, like they're sort of similar to the spikes that are on the outside of a virus. Whereas the A, they have A spikes, the B have B spikes, and AB blood has both spikes. So basically, we've developed or evolved our blood cells, you can say, in response to the external environment. And really interesting when then there's extra bits of information where people think that, you know, or there is like information on this that people with different blood groups can perhaps smell the differences. There's differences on other immune aspects of the body. So, yeah, it's really interesting that it means that we all have slightly different responses to viruses. They've looked at how people with different blood types have different susceptibility to cardiovascular disease and cancer, but I'm not sure about animals. Do you know anything on that, Carl?
No, but can I ask you another question? So we're talking about the red blood cells, which firstly don't have any DNA, and secondly make up about two-thirds or so of all the cells in our body. And so these spikes, are they made of fat or protein or carbohydrate or a weird mix?
Mostly protein, yeah, but a protein and a bit of carbohydrate. But, yeah, they're essentially like those antigen, like a spike, yeah, a protein.
Okay, so and then how does it happen that I end up getting a terrible virus and then because I've got a – how do I then pass on to my children that instead of – my children being O, they become A or B, which gives them resistance to this virus. How does that happen?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I don't know how they actually evolve from the O to the A type with the extra spike. One of those questions of evolution, isn't it, where it would take a long time. But, yeah, you're right, because at the moment all I know about is the fact that, you know, we pass on what we have, and the O, if you're an O blood type, that means you've got two O alleles or an O,
And the other thing about Africa is that overwhelmingly there, those people who are there or who came from there do not have any Neanderthal DNA, whereas the people who left Africa, like my European ancestors, they have, on average, everybody else has got about 3 to 4% Neanderthal DNA, and there seems to have been like a 7 to 10,000 year period when we bred with the Neanderthals, and I'm not even going to ask if that's related to blood because it's too complicated.
Yeah, but it is an interesting question of how quickly can we change things in a lifetime or over generations. But yeah, but sorry, don't know about the dogs or the animals.
Yeah,
that's right. Have to ask a vet, I suppose.
Yeah,
or a veterinary hematologist.
Thanks. Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Darren.
Thank you.
And no, we got Brent. We got Ben in Foster. Hey, Ben, what's your question about smell?
Hey, doctors. So a bit of a random one. I've got no sense of smell, but I do have a sense of taste. I just don't think it's as good as people who can smell and taste. I think my question is, like, to flip that, if you had no sense of taste, but you had a sense of smell, would that be affecting your taste still? Like, would you know that you didn't have a sense of taste because your smell was taking it on? Or, yeah.
Yeah, interesting questions. And as you say, people would experience different things based on how much they can smell versus how much they can taste, vice versa. And so we've all experienced, I'm sure, you know, when we're sick or we've got a blocked nose, that things taste differently. So taste is, you know, that sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami. And also we get information from our tongue, which is where the taste buds are, on the texture of food. So you can have that experience, and that's quite independent of the smell. But the smell is really what adds the detail and the depth and the interesting layers to what we're eating, because they're the aromas and, you know, those compounds, the chemicals, they travel up our nose, like the oral cavity and into our nose, and it's the very top part of the nose that allows us to smell, and that travels straight back to the brain. So it's that interesting connection as well between smell and memories and smells reminding us of things. But, yeah, so what do you experience? You can experience sort of the texture of the food and some taste?
Yeah, some taste. So those tastes that you mentioned, that's the basic ones like sweet, salty, sour, all of those tastes I can. But, you know, when it comes to, like, things that are fragrant, like herbs and stuff like that, then there's a bit of a waste of time on me. But I just thought, I wondered, like, if you had no sense of taste, would, when you're eating something that was very, you know, that had a lot of herbs in it, would you be tasting that through your smell? You
definitely.
Know, even though you didn't have a sense of taste.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You'd still be tasting a lot of that through your smell. And there's different tastes or smells that are noted more prominently via the taste buds on the tongue versus via the receptors in the nasal cavity. But it's interesting because there are smell training that you can do where they get you to smell specific essential oils like rose, lemon, cloves, eucalyptus, sort of strong smells, and it's an attempt to try and train your nose back to the smell.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I've smelled plenty of strong smells and nothing yet, so might have to give it a crack.
Yeah.
Thanks,
good
Ben.
Luck.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. We've gotten a text, someone saying, yes, dogs and cats have different blood types. Not so many as humans. Dogs have DEA 1.1 positive or negative.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Never heard of it. Yeah.
It's maybe extra homework for us.
Okay. Maybe that was a typo. We'll have to see. But either way, we've been doing science with Dr. Carl. Dr. Teresa Larkin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It went so fast.
I know.
So many amazing, interesting questions out there.
Yes, absolutely. You've worn your Oz Music t-shirt. We really appreciate it for Oz Music t-shirt day, art versus science. And if we want to see, A, what the t-shirt looks like, and B, where we can find more of your stuff on socials, where should we go?
Yeah, Dr. Teresa Larkin on Instagram is probably the best spot.
Amazing. Thank you so much for hanging out, Dr. Carl. We'll do this again next week.
Peachy keen.
And that's it. Thanks so much again to Dr. Teresa Larkin for joining us for this week's episode. I'll chuck her details for you in the show notes. And two more episodes left of Science with Dr. Carl between now and the end of the year. We're going to have some goodies for you over summer, but if you want to ask Dr. Carl a question, you've got two more opportunities. So make sure you're listening live, texting in on Thursdays from 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.